Conductor and composer Georg Tintner is best known for his interpretations of Bruckner symphonies recorded for Naxos in the 1990s. But that was just the final chapter in the life of a man who lived and breathed music but never achieved all he was capable of as a musician. Tanya Tintner, Georg's third wife, explains why in her biography, Out of Time, The Vexed Life of Georg Tintner, published by the University of Western Australian Press. Born in Vienna in 1929, Georg Tintner was the first Jew to join the Vienna Boys Choir, but it was run by the anti-Semite Joseph Schnitt who tormented him. Fleeing Vienna ahead of the Nazis, he settled first in New Zealand, where he conducted the Auckland Choral Society and Auckland String Players, but was not considered for the job of conductor of the newly formed National Orchestra because he wasn't a Commonwealth citizen. Frustrated, he went to Australia, where he conducted opera, and then spent a couple of years in London with Sadler's Wells Opera. He ended his career in Canada as leader of the Nova Scotia Symphony Orchestra, where he finally had the chance to record. A meeting with Klaus Heyman in Hong Kong led to a recording contract to do all of Bruckner's orchestral work. However, Georg only got to complete the symphonies before the pain of cancer proved too much, and at 82 he ended his own life. Chris Witter talked to Tanya Tintner about the biography and her relationship with Georg.
I met Georg quite by accident at the Sydney Opera House. He was sitting with a mutual friend, so I went down to introduce myself. Say hello.
As simple as that.
As simple as that.
Not a case of love at first sight, Tanya, I don't think.
Certainly not on my side. I can't speak for Georg, but in retrospect, I think he was interested.
Well, he was, because he actually chased you up quite vigorously.
A little, sometime later, but yes, he did, yes.
Yes, so he obviously hadn't forgotten you. You'd made an impression.
Evidently.
The age difference. He was 59, you were 22. Didn't matter to him. How did you feel about that difference, though?
Well, it was pretty scary, and I think in retrospect, that 36 years difference really was too much. You can't, especially with somebody of his background, being a refugee, living in so many different countries, I think it's 36 years is just too much, really.
He was obviously very set in his ways, but he was very set in his ways as a young man, which is something you point out as well in the book, Out of Time.
Single-minded, I think, is what he was.
Yes. Set in his way, single-minded, yes.
Single-minded is the polite.
Intensely single-minded. How did you deal with that?
I admired it, but it was hard to live with because a marriage has to be a marriage, not just somebody looking after someone else who is single-minded. And that was quite difficult.
Although he made it quite clear, didn't he, that he did not, because of the age difference, he didn't want to marry you so that you could be his nurse. He wanted you to marry you so that you could be his muse.
Correct.
Did that happen?
No, it didn't. There's many reasons for that, and it would take too long to explain them all here, but one of them is that I don't think, well, I know that I didn't support him as much as I should in his composing. But I also think that he had reached a stage of depression, which I didn't realise at the time, that really nothing would have helped him to compose.
He wasn't going to compose, was he, by the time you met him?
I don't think so.
No.
In retrospect, again.
How much of that influence on him, in terms of how much of the influence in your marriage were his first two marriages, and in particular Sue, his first wife? Because I just gained the impression he never really forgot that he'd been married to Sue.
That's correct. Yes, we had quite a lot of Sturm und Drang, one might say, at the beginning about this. I wasn't jealous of Sue or anything like that, but I was aware very early in the piece that she was, as I saw it then, she was the one who'd mattered most to him. Once he died and I started researching the book, I realised that she was the one who'd done the most for him. And that was quite an eye-opener to realise that.
Done the most for him in what sense?
She'd supported him in a way that the other two of us hadn't done. In fact, she came from a generation when the man was the head of the household and the wife supported the husband pretty well no matter what. But she had wanted somebody who was exotic and that she could look up to, and that's the way she treated him, well, at least until things started to go wrong. But she was an enormously loyal person, so she kept supporting him, perhaps long after she should have.
How difficult was it for you to research his first two wives, to find out all that you had to find out to complete the book about the two women he'd been married to? Was that hard for you?
Not really. I knew Well, he told me a lot about both of them. I'd met both of them. I knew Sue. We used to visit her from time to time. I liked her. And no, it wasn't difficult. It was the same as with the girlfriend. It wasn't hard to research those either.
He had a roving eye. Not so much by the time he'd met you.
It did rove. I think the only time it didn't really rove was during the second marriage. I think he just didn't have time.
But that was just par for the course, really.
Well, it had
particularly its first marriage.
Yes. Well, in those days, he thought that there are a number of things. This is what the artist is entitled to. This is what the artist in Vienna did all the time. This is what married men in Vienna did all the time. It was a matter of course that they went to prostitutes. And, of course, one needed inspiration for one's music. Now, if you actually look very carefully at it, it seems to me, at least I haven't found any evidence to the contrary, that he never actually wrote any music at all for girlfriends. It was the wives that he wrote music for, once he got married the first time, that is. There was the girlfriend as a teenager.
What was his attitude to the women he married? It sounds a silly thing to say. But with Sue and with Gretel and yourself, he didn't put you on a pedestal, I think far from it, but he kind of sort of kept you at the distance slightly, and there was a kind of almost a reverence from him for your position as his muse, even though you may not have been actually performing that duty, or what he saw as that duty.
I don't think that's quite it. He did put us on pedestals, actually. Or to, actually, to put it a better way would be to say that we captured his imagination.
Mm.
And it really had very little to do with whether we were suitable from the point of view of being a wife, being in a marriage. Mm. We had just somehow captured his imagination, and that was going to lead to the creation of music.
He saw no difficulty at all in the fact that there was a large age gap between yourself and him, and as the same there was with Gretel, with Cecilia. She was a much younger woman as well. It just seems to me that it was rather like his attitude to music. He was just blind to anything that he didn't see as being relevant. If he felt that it was right, then that was all that mattered.
No, I think that's not right at all. No, he was very aware of the age difference, and he was very aware of, as it were, tethering a young person to an old person. And he was very clear when he asked to marry me. He said, the only way I can justify asking you to marry an old codger like me, and he did use that expression, old codger, was if he could write the music. That was the only way he could justify that. Had he not thought he could write music, he would never have asked.
Isn't that extraordinary, though? Because he didn't actually write any music, did he?
He wanted to, though. He tried, but he just couldn't. And you know, I mean, I have some culpability in this. You know, I didn't take the interest that I should have taken in him. Not in him, but in the composing. I was interested, but I probably didn't show it as I should have.
Didn't help him write, but it must have helped his ability to continue conducting to a very ripe old age.
Irrelevant. No, he would have kept conducting in any case. The only reason he might have stopped, as it were, would be because he wanted to go away and write music, and conducting was just a distraction.
He is such a complex character. It's very difficult to actually understand the man.
He's very unusual, that's it. It's difficult.
And in fairness, I think you found that as well.
Well, yes, of course. But he is he's a very unusual character because he's a throwback to 100 years ago, and these people really don't exist anymore. So whether or not I've described him accurately or well, it is a hard personality to understand.
But he actually railed against his background. He railed against his formative years in Vienna. He left that behind. He deliberately never tried to go back to it.
You couldn't go back to it because the Vienna he'd grown up in was destroyed in 1938. There was nothing left of that. He did actually want to go back. He wanted to move back
not
there.
Not musically, Tanya, surely.
You couldn't go back musically. I mean, Vienna is still a musical centre. It's a pale shadow of what it used to be in the 20s and 30s. But he was a child of Austria. He always felt himself an Austrian, and he actually wanted to go back and live there in the last few years of his life.
So why didn't he?
We just somehow
just
didn't get around to it, and then he got sick and you know, no particular reason, just didn't happen.
You met him in Australia, of course.
Yes.
You went to Canada not long after, I think.
That was only a trip to National Youth Orchestra, actually. Yes. I met him in 76.
But that started the Canadian experience, didn't it?
For me, it did. He'd already been a few times previously to that.
Through John Brown.
Correct.
Yes. Now, John Brown's an interesting character as well. He seemed to be a loyal, firm, dedicated friend to Georg, and yet towards the end of that relationship, it turned completely on its head.
Exactly.
Which isn't really fully explained. Maybe there is no real explanation for his attitude.
I've explained it as well as I can. Yes. Georg never understood why he turned on him. It is possible that John was...
That John Brown was in charge of basically of organising the National Youth Orchestra.
He was the general manager of the National Youth Orchestra. And Georg had met him at the ABC in the 1950s when the Elizabethan Theatre Trust used the Sydney Symphony as its orchestra. Mm. And John had a job moving chairs around because he loved music. Yes. That's why he was there. And then he turned up in Canada. And I think when I say John was in love with Georg, I don't mean in any homosexual way at all. He just thought Georg was, well, God, really. And, well, I don't know. I think maybe he thought I'd got in his way, which occurred to us much later. I certainly had no intention of doing that because, I mean, John Brown did so many wonderful things for Georg. And I think also John, I think his sanity wasn't all that great in later years, actually.
My point in mentioning John Brown is that a number of people held that opinion of Georg that he worked with or worked for. The composer Alfred Hill, who was not noted for being one who was particularly outgoing, who just adored Georg. Our own wonderful composer, Douglas Lilburn, a very introverted personality in the sense that he didn't want to be seen in public very much at all and certainly didn't welcome visitors to any great extent, but open arms for Georg and yourself.
Quite so, yes.
What was it about Georg that made people of that calibre find him so attractive and so wonderful for them and for the music?
I think in the case of Douglas, they were actually quite like-minded. They had very different sexuality, they had very different upbringings, but they were both rigorously honest and absolutely devoted to their art. And I think they recognised that in each other. Georg certainly recognised that Douglas was, when I say expert composer, that almost writes him down. But he realised that this was a composer of huge quality. Georg thought he was the finest composer in Australasia. I think they gravitated towards each other, especially at that time in New Zealand when, with all due respect, there weren't a lot of great musicians in the country. And to find each other would have been very important to them.
He settled originally in Auckland. Sue came out to live with him. And they started a poultry farm. They started a family as well, which they weren't going to do. That's another aspect of the book that you cover. He worked in Auckland. He made quite some stir in Auckland musical circles.
Well, he had his admirers and he had his devotees, and the people who worked with him mostly loved him. The 1YA studio orchestra didn't like him at all and signed a petition to that effect. We don't want to work with this man ever again. But he was certainly sadly missed when he left.
They didn't like him because he asked them to work.
Correct.
They had not been asked to work before. They'd basically gathered and done their own thing and gone home.
That's right.
And he wanted them to produce the best they could produce.
And he only had two rehearsals each time in which to do it with the Choral Society performances.
Yes. The job of conductor of the National Orchestra came up. He applied for it and didn't get it. Now, why was that? Because he had established a reputation as a conductor at that point.
Well, it happened several times that he tried, actually. In 1949, he was really only just starting out in Auckland. That was when Anderson Tyra left and Bowles got it. They just didn't want to consider New Zealand applicants. They just didn't circulate the resumes at all. They just weren't interested. They want somebody British. The same in 52 when Bowles left. They got Braithwaite in as interim. They just really had, in those days, in fact, that you had to be a Commonwealth citizen even to apply for this overseas. Mm. And the broadcasting was going to take whoever the BBC recommended, really. Georg didn't stand a chance.
Which was devastating for him, I think.
Well, when it came around again in 1963, he didn't bother applying. That's true. That was when Matteo Ricci got it.
Oh, right, yes. And Hopkins had been prior to that.
Yeah, he got it in 57.
Yes.
And he was the BBC's third choice. And William Yeats, who was the director of broadcasting, got extremely upset about that.
Because it wasn't the first choice.
But, gentlemen, you are going against the opinion of the BBC.
It's an extraordinary attitude. And I think it's Ken Ward that refers to his career being influenced by the views of pompous little people with prejudices. I love that. Which sums it up.
It was very Anglo-centric, Anglophilic, yes, yes, at the time. And I'm afraid Georg was seen as a bloody foreigner. Not the only one, but yeah, he was.
So he went to Australia.
In '54,
and then Sue and the children followed after.
In '58,
yes, and he was quite busy in Australia. He actually had a lot of work in Australia, but it was very spasmodic still.
When he first started, there wasn't. He went over there to join this National Opera Company of Australia, yes, so-called, which is really greatly overrated. It's important, that title. They toured New Zealand, and then they took him back with him. And then in early 1955, that company just collapsed, which is why it took so long for Sue and the children to come, because he didn't want to sell up the farm until he was quite sure he had work. Mm. So for quite some time, he was really out of work, apart from coaching or playing the piano at ladies' evenings or this sort of thing. Mm. It wasn't until 57 that he got some coaching with the New Trust Opera and then joined them permanently in, I think it was late 57, 58.
But he kept giving his money away anyway, didn't he? I mean, he was worried about security, but he kept giving it away all the time.
Exactly, exactly. Three wives got quite upset about that.
but isn't that just part of his character? I mean, he was always looking up for other people. You were okay. You were with him, therefore you were okay.
Well, you had a roof over your head and food on your table, enough.
He would not harm even a moth.
No.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? He would take a moth and place it outside rather than see it.
Or a cockroach, that's right.
Whatever it was, yes. Mm. Any living thing.
That's right.
Not so close to his own children.
Well, it was partly geography. You know, he didn't spend that time in the same location as they were. That was part of the trouble. And then in Australia, in the 3 years between when Sue came and when the marriage broke down, he was away for half the time, touring around Australia in this godforsaken bus with this godforsaken opera company, playing in godforsaken halls. He just wasn't there.
Why did he never return to... Well, he did return to Europe. He tried to return to Europe, I think, when he was married to Gretel. They moved back to England. Didn't work. And yet again, he received very, very high praise from musicians, from critics in England, in Europe. But it didn't work.
There was only one really sensational. There were good reviews in the regions, but that didn't really count in London. And the one really sensational review by Peter Hayworth of his Magic Flute, yes, at the Coliseum came out, I think it was 3 weeks before he left the country, and by that time he'd already accepted the job in Perth, and okay, it was much too late. He wasn't going to change his mind anyway. He'd had enough of England. He'd been there for 3 years, wasn't working. He wasn't getting on with Charles Mackerras. They were giving him all the wrong operas. They were giving him operettas, actually.
So, Bruckner, always for Georg, the epitome of musical excellence in terms of composition, I think.
His love. He'd fallen in love with Bruckner, yes, probably around the age of 8. Yeah.
Two people pivotal in terms of the Bruckner recordings for which Georg is now remembered. Rightly or wrongly, people think Georg Tintner, Bruckner, Naxos. What was your involvement in setting up the Naxos recordings?
Well, we'd gone to Hong Kong because Georg was invited several times to the Academy for Performing Arts to conduct there. And Klaus Heyman lives in Hong Kong. And I said to Georg, I want to go and ask Klaus if you could please have just one Bruckner recording. This was really the last major composer that Klaus hadn't recorded. He'd made a couple of false starts, hadn't worked. And Georg said, no, he'll never get anything. Please don't go, waste of time. I said, I didn't come all this way and not at least try. The worst he can do is throw me out the door. So I made an appointment, and Klaus was very gracious. And the day I went, Georg decided to come too, which is very surprising because he didn't go in for self-promotion. Well, we went up to his lovely apartment on the peak, and I asked about Bruckner. And Georg and Klaus got to talking and discovered they liked all the same composers, Pfitzner, Bruckner, Schmidt, these sorts of people. Klaus offered him not just one recording, but to record all the symphonies of Bruckner, in fact, everything orchestral that Bruckner ever wrote, all the different versions, which is a big topic in musicology, all the different versions of Bruckner, which probably would have been about 27 CDs had he done them all.
But he didn't.
ran out of time. He did one set of the 11 symphonies, one version each, and that was it.
Part of the Adagio from Bruckner's Symphony No. 6, recorded by the NZSO with Georg Tintner in 1995.